What do you mean by flows within
that's,
the
that's what I mean, but I say the interesting thing, and then I explain how we get there. Now you're all going to pay attention, because you're going to want to know what that is. So now we start to head into slightly more the development of it. So this is the book by Robert Yelanowitz. He wrote another one more targeted towards, I won't need to turn up the lights because I'm going to have to use the boards. There we go. But this book is called Growth and Development. It's his more mathematically oriented book of the two. His second book was, he tried to convince biologists that you could develop a mathematical system to determine how ascendant an ecology is, how well it has evolved. Now, the problem is he takes stuff from information theory and he sort of willy-nilly throws it all together and then says, look at all these different systems. It seems to work for these, so we're just going to say this is good enough and we should use these measures. He still actually does that. So when I first heard about it, I was kind of like, Stu brought it up, and I was kind of like, oh, this is a little wonky being a mathematician. I'd like a bit more foundation. And Stu said, no. We'll get you these matrices called input-output matrices from the U.S. economy, and you run them on them. If there's something interesting, great. If there isn't, you're not wasting that much time.
Say how well the ecosystem has evolved.
Yeah, he develops a measure he calls ascendancy. And the title of the book is actually where he got the idea for the measure, is he takes a concept of growth of the ecosystem, how much flow there is happening within the ecosystem, and a concept of how organized that flow is occurring. Now, I understand the reaction. That's the reaction I had. And I still have that reaction. I'm still trying to figure out what these measures are. But he proceeds to argue using standard ecological models that have existed, that these seem to work. And then the ascendancy is a generally accepted measure within ecological modeling.
So can you fill me in as to what your objection is to that use of the terminology?
Which terminology?
You've reduced his to yours. You're saying you're still having trouble with...
Oh, because it doesn't have a foundation as to why the average mutual information, why... He takes the ascendancy matrix of the flows and looks at something called the average mutual information.
Sorry, I think that's not my question.
Okay.
My guess is that his objection might be different than yours.
Can I make a suggestion? Because he hasn't presented any of this yet. Maybe
Amazon.com page.
But the rest of us have no idea what's going on. So maybe we need to actually present the material.
The use of the terminology.
I don't care. Let's see the material, then we'll understand what Brett said.
Okay. So... this is
book, and then come back and say it again so we all can understand.
So I got a guy named Barry Nolte at the University of Calgary hooked me up with a bunch of input-output matrices, which you can get from this website. And these give you, they divide the economy into 194 sectors, everything from bowling centers to oil and petroleum. And they look at the flow of value through the economy, which is developed is actually the inverse direction of money through the economy, and then it's adjusted for inflation. So that's where I got the data from. I ran the data through input-output, through his formulas, and I saw it work. I'm just leaving this up here for now. I'm going to actually show you what these formulas are now. So what happens is, with an ecology, is you can view it as a bunch of different spatial sectors, a bunch of different sectors. The same thing with an economy. And you can define a flow of some conserved quantity through the system. So with an ecology, you can define it as carbon flow. That's what he uses in his book as an example. But you can easily use this for power networks where there's power flow through a system. And then for an economy, you could view it either as money flow through the economy, so you view these bunch of different firms and how the money moves through those. You view them as a bunch of different economic sectors and how the money moves through those. You basically coarse grain your system and you draw a flow diagram. Now, what's incorporated into this is the system is not a closed system. You also incorporate external inputs and losses or uses to the outside world. Commonly they're drawn as ground lines. So what you end up with is an idea of how some conserved quantity is flowing through the system. Okay. With this, each one of these edges now, you can assign some weight, which now at this point we assign by looking at observations of the system. We assign the observed amount of flow we saw move between each of these coarse grain sectors. If we can observe incoming flow, we put the incoming flow. If we can observe lost flow, we put the lost flow. And then, in the words of Carol Frost, when I asked her how they did the input-output matrices, the accountants show up and they do a lot of little black magic and they make everything balance. Okay? Or in an ecological environment, the ecological people show up, they look at the matrix and they go, I need to have it so every single node has the same amount of flow coming into it as it's coming out of it. So usually they do that by increasing or decreasing the losses or gains. So now, with this, we can create a matrix M, which is the adjacency matrix of this directed graph, where each cell is the value of the amount of flow for that graph. We have one extra column and one extra row. The extra row is the inputs, these external inputs to the system, and the extra column is the losses from the system. Okay? So the way you can view it as is if this column here, let's say column A, has 5 units of flow to sector B, you would write 5 there. If column A has 2 units of flow to itself, you can write 2 there. Okay? If column B has 1 unit of flow back to A, you can write 1 there. Okay? And then we'll just say 0, and I can draw this associated graph for you. It'll look originally like this. We have to balance everything, so I just say that we ground line this with 4, and this guy has 5 leaving and 2 coming back to itself, 1 here, so we say there's a 6 input. Okay. How those two are done for the input-output matrix is a little more complex, but you can get the rough idea. So now we have this matrix that represents this flow system.
You're hearing 5 go out, 2 come back, and 6 go in?
Oh, sorry. This should be 4. Because the loop has no contribution added to the loop I asked. So you have actually 7 going out.
And 1 coming
one
back.
1 coming back.
Right.
But this 2 is coming back as well.
And so 1 below, yeah.
The universal source to the universal sink is always 0.
Yeah. Okay. So now that we have this matrix, and this is Tenra, if you wanted some of the best stuff on input-output stuff, this is a great book. It's all math, and it describes very clearly how a lot of the input-output stuff for the economy has been used historically. So now that I have this matrix, I have sort of a representation of how the system is flowing. So I'm gonna give a bunch of measures here so I can actually explain in more detail what everything is. So if I'm going to say Mij is the amount of flow from the ith sector to the jth sector, I'm going to say Mi is the sum of Mij over j, so basically that's your row sum. It's the amount of outgoing flow leaving I. I'm going to say Mj prime is the summation of Mij over I. That's your column sum. It's the amount of flow entering J. And I'm going to say M is the total flow through the system. So sum of everything. Okay, so I already have half of this growth and development thing I was telling you about with ascendancy. Because what you, I know it says at this point is, if we look at M, that tells us how much carbon or whatever we're looking at, money, is flowing through it through the period of time we're observing. Okay? So we have an idea of, as M grows, the ecological system is growing, or if in an economic world, as M grows, the amount of money changing hands is growing, especially if you adjust for inflation, which we do. Okay? So that's the first half. The second half is you take these measures and you calculate something called average mutual information of this matrix. What this works out to, and I'll explain what this is in a second. So this is Mij over M, so the probability of, if you were just to view one flow anywhere in the matrix, this is the probability of viewing that specific flow from I to J, log Mij times the total flow over the outgoing flow the incoming flow of I and the outgoing flow of J. Incoming flow of J. So if you were observing I and J independently, this as a communication channel, this is why it's called mutual information, this would be the amount of correlation you'd have if you knew something left I, how likely you would know where it went to J. The higher this is, the more mutual information there is for the flows. Ulanowitz, you basically just puts it there and says, this is a measurement of organization of how the flow structure is, because the more organized the flow structure is, the higher this measure is. And he is correct in that from an information theoretic point of view, if the system is completely random, you'll get zero for this. So, and if the system is very, very highly ordered, you will get a good value. So if you have a perfect cycle, this will be very high.
When you say, the system is completely random, you mean that the matrix over here is random?
Yeah, the matrix is random. So if everybody's throwing it to everybody else.
And I guess the analogy to probability would be that if you thought about these as stochastic automata, then you have transition probabilities in there.
Yeah, that's where this comes from. And then you can derive the AMI from the diagram.
What is the denominator there on the right?
MI, MJ prime. This one?
What's the prime?
The prime is, MJ prime means it's what's coming into J. So if it's prime, it just means it's what's coming into me. It's just a way to differentiate between the two. Okay. So now, Ulanowitz's idea was, this is useful enough to do ecological modeling, discover how an ecosystem is doing, but it doesn't give me any organization. So if I have an ecosystem, and I pour a bunch of food into the ecosystem, and everything's growing randomly, it's not really an evolved ecosystem. So he said, we need to incorporate growth and development. So he said, why don't we just do this? He multiplies growth times development, and he gets what he calls the ascendancy measure. Okay. The ascendancy measure is what he believes, phenomenologically from his experiments and blah, 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 a measure of how well evolved an ecosystem is. What it actually ends up being, and I proved this a few months ago, is it's actually a log likelihood test. If you view the matrix is a series of observations. The ascendancy measure is the log likelihood test that matrix is not random. So the higher your ascendancy measure is, the more confident you can be that the matrix you're viewing is not completely random. Now, this has a lot of implications. For example, if you divided your economy badly or your ecology badly, your ascendancy measure will go down. It can actually end up being a measure of how well you've divided the system, not a measure of how ascendant the system is. However, as your system becomes more and more organized within the structures as you've defined it, this does actually go up.
What do you mean multiply by development?
Well, he multiplied by the average mutual information. So the more organized the system is. He viewed.
So this is a measure of organization.
Yeah.
So you're measuring something like carbon capture and growth by the level of organizedness.
He looks at the flow of carbon through the ecosystem. And he got the total flow of carbon, let's say, through the ecosystem.
And carbon flowing through the system is assumed to be good in some way.
Well, he views it as, he views it as more carbon is flowing through the system, there's more there. There's more happening. The system is growing.
Why not just measure productivity?
That's
essentially biomass production.
It's biomass production. And he's basically saying, the thing is he's just trying to measure basically how, he's taking the flow network of carbon, and he's trying to measure how big is it, how much is going on, And how organized is it? And so that's what his primary goal was. Now that's an aside to the more exciting stuff.
I mean, if you approach this a little more theoretically or something, you're saying, okay, the random thing is very low. And then you think of, well, why do industries buy from other industries or sell? Because they're making specialized products.
Yes.
And what I'm not sure of is if what we would define as, you know, the ultimate specialization.
Yeah.
And because you think about it.
Well, it's a balance.
Yeah, right, but we have one scale that we know, randomness
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
You'd like to have some metric that would say this is completely special. Well, maybe completely specialized as each industry only sells to itself. That maybe that is the alternative. There's no linkage here. And now you're looking for some intermediate thing that you think is more, one may imagine being more associated with economic productivity or something.
Well, the thing is, the average mutual information is not just, you know, if everybody was just feeding to themselves, the AMI is actually quite low. Because AMI is, there has to be information there as well. So it's deviation from randomness, but it's also confidence in deviation from randomness. So there has to be some structure there for the AMI to be high. It's the same thing as if I had a communication channel with you, and I was sending you 1-1-1-1-1-1-1 over and over again,
right.
And you were getting 1-1-1-1-1 over and over again. Yes, we have a perfectly clean channel, and we both have exactly the same thing, but our mutual information is low because there's no real information being transmitted between the two of us. So the same thing with this is if the system was ultra simplistic, the AMI will go down because in the simplicity is a loss of information.
Fair enough. Okay, so since you think of these input-output tables at least, it's
yeah.
technically determined under some optimizing, for the moment, optimizing thing. So you would have thought the particular input-output table you got was each firm was buying, in the most efficient way it could, or each industry, excuse me, buying most efficiently. So I would buy business services, but I wouldn't buy food.
That's if you're using the input-output matrix. Yeah, there's ways of using them. I'm taking these pure tables without those optimizations. I know what you're talking about.
Okay, it's just going to be hard to interpret if.
Because basically, I'm just looking at the evaluated flows.
Right.
Okay. I'm not looking at any optimization.
Right, but then you're going to want to relate it to the growth of GDP.
Yeah, that's
it has to have some meaning.
But that's the thing is I don't know why, to be honest, AMI is related to the GDP.
Oh, so I'm looking for a reason for you that makes some sense.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm trying to do.
Okay. You can tell the difference between a mathematician and anybody else. A mathematician is like, what? It's a number.
Can you characterize the matrix? So for a fixed n by n size matrix, what are the types of matrices that maximize the AMI?
A cycle matrix does very well.
Single
very good
cycle.
Job. Yeah, single cycle matrix does a very good job. If a tree does an incredible job, actually. If you if everybody has two children, that does an unbelievable job of maximizing it. But the thing is, also, as you cut the number of edges down, you fundamentally have less flow because there's less roads to flow down. Sort of like having a highway. If you have one highway, it's very obvious, but you can't get as much down it. So that's why the ascendancy measure is nice, because the more edges you are, the total flow naturally goes up.
You're gonna have a higher AMI, say, if you have a matrix that's got ones for every entry, than one that's got ones on the diagonal but zeros off.
Yeah, that'll work. Okay, so that's the ascendancy measure, and that's what the AMI is. Now, the interesting thing is I really didn't know how that related to anything. I did know some statistics. You're probably right. There's probably some argument with regarding to the organization that might explain it. I think actually there may be an argument regarding resilience. I found a measure recently that's resilience, and it's very similar to the AMI. And in fact, especially where it matches up on that chart, it's quite fascinating. Because that caught my attention, I decided I would go one more step in to the system. Oh, please say this fills the screen. Good. And I decided that I'd start calculating all sorts of interesting ecological measures using the U.S. economy data. So using this matrix over here, this M, we can calculate what is in biology called a trophic level. So a way of visualizing, a quick way of explaining trophic levels is, so you have your plants. Your plants, let's say in the optimal world, aren't dependent on anything, so a trophic level 1. Then you have your herbivores. Your herbivores need the plants. And we're going to assume, like, this is way specified. They're level 2. You have your carnivores. They need both the herbivores and plants, level 3. Omnivores, level 4. And if you know, you're in some weird world, you might have 5, 6, 7, whatever. We can do that. We can calculate that actually directly from these flow matrices, because the flows within the ecology are flows of who eats who, basically. So what we do is we take M, and we create another matrix S, which is defined as, so Sij, a node of that matrix, is defined as Mij over Mi. So you basically divide the rows by the total of the rows. What does this do to your graph? Now the outgoing edges are the percent of flow that goes along those edges. Okay? You cut out the, I'm going to use non-equalizer economic terms for it. You cut out the value added row, and you cut out the final demand row. Yeah, value added row, final demand column, those are your ground line and your input lines. And you get this matrix Sii. Okay? With Sii, if you were to square it, that tells you the percent of flow that goes to two people two steps away from you. If you were to cube it, that tells you the percent of flow that goes to people three steps away from you. If you were to, and so on, you would get for paths of all lengths. If you take the summation, S0 plus S1 plus S2 plus S4, and everybody in economics should start to recognize this, you have the Leontief inverse. Leontief in the 40s did this. You can calculate this, and it's a very beautiful proof in Tenra. I don't have time to do it right now, but this is equal to this, and the proof in Tenra uses actually economics. The proof is equal to this because there is a shadow price that is valid for this matrix. And it's due to the fact that
that's just an identity of matrices.
It's an identity of matrices, and matrices have a certain property. Not all, you can't take this summation for some matrices.
Fair enough.
Yes, because this can be growing, you know.
In particular, if it's equal to the identity.
Yeah. So, and this is just something interesting.
Yeah, it has to be norm less than 1 in some sense.
Yeah, it's that. But there's the proof in Tenra is
just beautiful.
To
exist.
It's just, it's a proof that you don't think would really be useful. Yeah, anyway, so you have this. You have this matrix, which I would call L, because it's the Leontief matrix. What this ends up being is your cell entries is, in a way, the amount of flow that leaves you and goes to every other cell for all other paths. Okay? So what you can do is, to get the trophic level, or at least what Ulanowitz did, is you take your column sums. Because your column sums of this matrix are how much you're getting from all other cells in that network for all paths. So what you see here on the bottom here, from 1 to this little guy down here, which is a local government passenger transit, is the trophic levels of 194 sectors of the US economy in 1983. Okay? Antitrophic levels, the way you calculate them is you start from the beginning, you turn all your arrows around, so now instead of looking at flow of value, you're looking at flow of money, do all the same calculations. I invented this just because I wanted to get the other side of the equation, and that gives you the idea of how much your sector is dependent upon, how much other people's money has come into your sector. And what you can see is in 1983, right here at the top is metal mining. This guy here is non-ferrous, and this guy here is petroleum. This guy here is recycling. So you have these two measures. Okay, the size of the bubble is the amount of money that moved through that sector for that year. And the color of the bubble, based on the heat map, is what's called the cycling coefficient. And what that is if you take this matrix here, and you take a diagonal, that tells you along all paths of all lengths how much came back to you. Amazingly, With a little more work, you can derive Keynesian cycling coefficients from those.
I would have thought that the raw materials would be at the bottom, not at the top. Maybe I don't understand the
way. Okay, because anti-trophic is the opposite side.
Anti-trophic.
It's sort of the dual to the trophic.
All right, fine.
Yeah.
And so can you tell us some of the things that are at the...
That's dairy, that's meat. So if you're a vegetarian, you're destroying the U.S. economy. that's apparel, that's cars, carpets.
And what are like the big ones?
That's construction. It's what you'd expect it to be. Construction, retail, owner-occupied dwellings, real estate, wholesale.
Is that the one with software?
These guys? Oh, software, it doesn't exist yet. It's 1983. And it's actually under the category. And I'll show you this in a second. You can actually see Silicon Valley grow on this graph.
What's the one in the lower left corner?
No, it's actually right about...
one down there in the lower left.
Oh, those are okay, so the data, unfortunately, and this is actually an issue, has a lot of issues with it. And they have a lot of columns and they have a lot of rows that don't feed into anybody and don't receive anything from anybody. What happens is, with these measures, is it just gets spit down here. These are things like intergovernmental trading and stuff like that. So there's your electronic components.
One clarifying question. What's the x-axis there?
The x-axis is a trophic level. So the further you are this way, the more you spend money within the economy.
Cars you steal, you use coal.
Okay. Vertical axis, the higher you are that way, the more people within the economy spend money on you. Okay? So... since I don't have a lot of time to go into a ton of detail, I'm going to show you some of the more interesting aspects of this. So I don't know how to...
Quick question. Okay. There's obviously, something can be in many levels at once, right?
Yeah.
And so you're actually quoting as average trophic levels.
It's given given these observations.
Right. But my question is then, have you looked at the dispersion in trophic levels? It would be interesting to know, you could imagine... if things were random, you're going to have a certain level of dispersion. Less than random, the dispersion is going to
show. Commonly, the trophic levels are done is just sort of taking the floor of these numbers. That's how Milanowitz does it. Because the reason is you're in this trophic level, even if technically you could be in more than one.
Right.
I don't take the floor because I want more of an idea of what's going on. If you take the floor, pretty much this whole thing goes boom.
If you still look at the dispersion, it's still interesting to know how many things are really just in one trophic level versus... you know, you're quoting a number and they're averaging over all five trophic levels.
No. I'm not averaging. I'm just taking the sum of a column in here.
Okay.
So it's a way of measuring how much other people are dependent. And there is an economic way of defining it. It's basically if you assume that every sector wants to pull one value added and stick it into savings, that this is the number you get.
There's a book by Hirschman called Strategy of Economic Development.
Yeah.
Which, do you know it?
It's on my list of stuff that I have to.
Okay, because he treats these as backward and forward linkages as the words he uses for the same thing.
Yeah.
And there was a big issue in development is, for instance, if you're a sector that's buying lots of things in the economy,
yeah,
in a developing country, the notion was that sector would put pressures on the earlier sectors,
yes,
to improve their efficiency.
Yes.
And so that was a backward linkage that spurred growth. The forward linkage was that you're a sector and you're super good. You are now helping the other sectors along. And at that point, I think the analysis kind of came to an end.
Yeah. Okay, so just as things that I love this graph here. I'm going to show you a move without actually highlighting anything first. This is from 1983 to 2000. This is how the US economy essentially evolved during that period of time with trophic levels and stuff. What's interesting is you can actually see the results of very specific policy decisions fundamentally changing the structure of the economy. Because this, you know how I have final demand and value, I also don't have imports or exports.
You had an annual series on import-output matrices?
Yes.
Yeah, who's doing it? Was BEA?
Yeah.
Annual?
And they have it to 2006. I didn't want to run to 2006 because I wanted 6 years for me to make predictions. Run them on the ones that I don't have. And I have a few predictions which I want to run on the ones that I don't have. So if I go way back here, you see metal mining is way up here in a very almost artificial place. There was some interesting economic policy in the 80s that Reagan did, including helping Harley Davidson. And it ended up basically In my opinion, it pushes metal mining up there. However, around 87, you had a liberalization of trade in the States. And so people started importing metal from outside the States. So what do you see? Metal mining becomes less antitropic. It doesn't mean that people aren't using metal in the economy. It means that people aren't using metal from that sector. Okay? Another interesting result, if I go, is the electronic components one, which I don't want to spoil the ending in case you know you guys don't remember what happened in the 90s. Okay? So not very much happens during the 80s. It moves up and down a bit. But then you can watch, as Silicon Valley grows, you can see electronics start to blow. And grows, and grows, and grows, and slowly goes to the right.
A lot of that's being imported now, so I guess...
It is being imported now. That's why I have the last six...
Yeah.
I'm curious what the last 6 years are going to be. I only ran into 2000. Again, like I said, there's all sorts of interesting data to this. You guys can have access to it.
I don't see in your alphabetic order the finance.
Finance? It may be under banking. Hold on a second. There's so many things here.
Maybe it's just
financial services. Should be
you don't call it any there.
There's insurance agents there.
Miscellaneous.
If you guys want access to it, and I hope you guys do, because it's all available online. That's the address right there.
Tiny Earl.
OS1337HAN0R.com/economychart.html.
Is it connected to your website?
My website is there, but don't read it. I'm a dirty commie, according to some of my friends. So
you will.
That O in Hacksaw is at
zero.
It's zero. I bought it a long time ago. So.
Hope you didn't pay a lot.
No. It's what happens when you hang out with the CSO.
What is this tool you're using, the program?
This program? Oh, this is Google. Google has a visualization thing. And I just, I have the numbers, and I just ran it through Google. It's called, what is the title of it here? Google Docs. If you go to Google Docs, it's one of their data visualization things. It's called a bubble chart.
It's in the spreadsheet.
It's just in your Google Docs spreadsheet. It's a really great way of visualizing for five or more dimensions.
Yes.
Especially because there's actually more data in here, and there will be even more, but it's all listed there. So, yeah. So basically, I'm at a point now where I'm just sort of taking all these numbers and trying to figure out what they all mean. I have a derivation of trophic levels, anisotropic levels, and stuff from an economic perspective. But it's still being pieced together, and hopefully within the next 3 or 4 months, I'll have something that I can publish and develop.
Are these categories constant? I mean, they seem to be small categories, big categories. They seem.
It's actually an issue with the input-output matrices. There's 194 categories that the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses.
And they've been constant over time?
They've been constant as far back as they go.
And they have videotapes?
They have. If you actually want some more humorous ones, they have, where is it here? Bowling centers.
They're back up, probably, yeah.
So let's see bowling centers.
Bowling centers?
They're coming back.
It doesn't really move much. It just kind of becomes.
It's coming back.
Yeah. there's bowling centers. What's interesting about the tropic levels and antitropic levels is there's arguments if you were to. If we all spent money on dairy meat and cars, it means more, and we're Americans, it means more of the money will stay within the economy before it leaves the economy. And that's just the property of how, what the trophic levels are measuring.
Even if you eat Kobe beef and drive a BMW?
Well, I guess you'd have to buy, American dairy, American cars. Because these are American industry, too. So if you're buying it from offshore, you'd actually be helping.
But this is this is GDP or what are you basing it on? Are the goods in GDP or GNP? I mean, are you worrying about ownership of assets or are you?
Basically, the higher your trophic level is, the more the money stays within the system that you have. before it leaves.
But what I'm trying to say is, are they measuring who owns the assets or just where it's produced?
No, they're measuring the flow of the. This here is not measuring any map. The size is the amount that's leaving that sector that year.
It's leaving the sector within the.
Year.
So it's within the borders of the U.S.
Yeah.
Just where it's
GDP. So it's your first thing then that gets. This is like the internal structure of the productive part of this production system. But the value added and the productivity is not part of this. Is it just the flows running around?
Yeah.
And of course, we want to see, as somebody raised earlier, how this is connected to the labor productivity. For the moment, just think of labor productivity. We could do capital productivity or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that's where your first exciting thing was.
Oh, so you want me to go all the way back to that first?
Well, because it's why the
here's why I think
more flows inside would be connected to better productivity.
Here's why I think the GDP thing is connected. If you see the bottom here, this is the globalist cycling coefficient. What the global cycling coefficient is you take all of these edges here, these LIIs, you multiply them by the outgoing flow from that, and that gives you the rough amount of flow that cycled through that sector that year, based on the observations. The vertical here is the average mutual information. There's a high correlation between the two. I have a feeling that what we're seeing is some effect of, if the money is cycling, it's predictive of the percent change, because the GDP isn't leaving the economy as rapidly. But I'm not sure, and I really don't want to make those statements blanket-wise. What's neat is, in case nobody noticed it, is so you see this peak here? This is 1987. You see that peak there, just before the collapse? It's 1988. You see this guy fall here, before that thing goes down? They're all 1 year off, and I don't know why. So so you can also see the two scatter plots. If that's for the same year, that's for the previous year. It goes up dramatically. I don't know.
You said in the car, for example, when you showed the car circle, I'm just still trying to figure out, that's all cars produced in the U.S. It doesn't matter whether they're owned by another country.
Because you're also getting the exports.
So this could be the profits could be going out.
Absolutely. Yeah, it could be.
This is part of the discussion we were having at lunch about
access.
I think it's time
to
talk. Here's the thing. I can't evaluate it well with respect to the economy. It looks pretty interesting to me. I'm not sure exactly what those things are proxies for, but I'm not saying the model is invalid. But the metaphor you're using of the evolution of ecosystems and the measures you're using, the throughput of the systems and the complexity of the systems, are, to say the least, going to require an extraordinary
No. That's why I said, these are Ulanowicz's measures that he's been defending for 20 years.
Okay, that may be, but here's the thing. A Baroque machine that puts out a lot of extra heat and has complexity in it that's unnecessary is better than a simple...
No. That's the thing. Is the EMI, it knocks, if the complexity is unnecessary, it'll catch that.
Well, but wait a second. Ecosystems do not evolve. They are... epiphenomena of the evolution of
the
Lord. Individuals
yes.
that are parts of these species within the ecosystems. And that's not a semantic point. Now, when you take a tree and you take it out of a forest, right, and you put it on the edge where it has access to more light and resources because it's not surrounded by its competitors, it'll get smaller. It won't get larger. Now, the point is your measure will say that this is in some sense a less successful organism as long as you're including a measure of its complexity. If you simply measured its carbon capture, you might be all right, because then it's going to spit out a bunch of extra propagules, and you'll see that. You'll see this smaller, more efficient tree that's investing less in trunk, more in photosynthetic area.
Evolution is probably not the best word to use. Because the way you're referring to it, you're right. The idea with the ecosystem stuff, what Ulanowicz touches on, is systems with high ascendancy can withstand impacts and changes much better than systems with low ascendancy.
It's a little hard for me to evaluate that statement. I don't see, it looks to me like by using the evolutionary metaphor, applying it to a forest that does not evolve because it does not reproduce.
That's why I'm acknowledging that.
Right, but by doing that, you are
putting a tremendous weight around your ankle. If this model is a good model for the economy, you should figure out what it does map to, and you should.
That's why I said there are actually economic reasons these measures are interesting, and the AMI is interesting. I'm deriving those from statistics. Like for example, what the ascendancy measure ends up being is the chi-squared measure. Okay, it actually has a legitimate measure of what's going on there, and basically it's saying if you have this series of observations, how is this structure, the system of flows? That's why I try to use the term conserved quantity. If you were to hit it hard, if you were to take an edge out of that system, what would happen? And what happens is with the high ascendancy measure, it actually remains resilient. Okay, I understand what you're saying using the evolutionary metaphor. There's a lot of luggage and there's a lot of battles that go on with that.
For no benefit that I can see.
No,
is that where it came from? You got it from this book that was using it in that context. Is that correct?
Well, okay.
That's why I'm wondering why he used it. Is that the only reason?
I used it because Jelanowicz's use of language is less than perfect. He uses it as he says ecosystems move towards a state where they try to be as stable as possible. He's talking about the ecosystem as a whole.
And then that's what you're.
Even that language, the idea that the ecosystem tries to do anything, this is not a semantic.
I'm not trying to.
He said moves.
Moves. I'm not saying tries.
I think you did just say try, but that can be interesting.
You're saying that this concept is actually predictive of something. Forget the name. The nomenclature is irrelevant.
Yes.
You're saying that this concept is actually predictive of something, and somebody else has named it something terrible.
Yes. Thank you. On a completely separate point, and this is actually because you're waving at me wildly. On a completely separate point, I really want to touch on this. I'm doing also graph analysis on these input-output matrices. I'm actually doing what's called graph spectral analysis. So I'm kind of curious about what the structure is. What is the economy actually looking like? And if you look at the integrated distribution, you get more or less what you'd expect. It's more or less what I'd expect. However, the upgrade distribution was completely...
Sorry, what do you mean more or less what I expect?
I was expecting something that kind of looked like...
I don't know what these are. What is an integrated distribution?
Okay, I look at the M, and I binarize the network. If you're 0, you're 0. If you're not 0, you're 1. Now I have a directed graph. Okay, out-degree distribution is how many arrows do I have leaving me going to other people. In-degree is how many arrows do I have coming into me.
Okay? And the distribution is the probability of that any selected.
Yeah, will be there. And so this to me was not. This is weird, but I thought that this was more or less fine. It's the bimodal one on the top that I thought was interesting. Is that the economy seems to be separated into people with a small number of outgoing nodes, so they don't touch very many sectors. And a large number of outgoing nodes. Now, this may be a property of the input-output matrices. It could be a commentary and telling people using the SMA and stuff to, rethink their matrices. But it also could be just an interesting property.
Or it may be a matter of things that are more like final goods versus intermediate.
That's what I'm thinking. Right. So I'm looking at this closer. I'm also looking to see how the structure works. Because if you take the matrix that I just defined to you, and you do you take the eigenvalues of that matrix, you can get an idea of how connected it is.
Right.
And by looking at that connections, you can get some interesting ideas as to the structure of the system.
If you're to put a slider and change your quantization for your binary graph transformation from 1 up to whatever the max is, what is your intuition about how that bimodality evolves? Is that simply, what I'm saying, is that an artifact of your quantization, that that's such an artificial quantization?
Don't say evolves.
Say what? How does that change the direct function of that linear slider?
Oh, so like if I bend it.
If you bend it 5 under and 0, 6 and above is actually connected?
The bimodal stays.
It stays. Okay.
It stays. And it stays explicitly because you see how high that 180 is there.
Right.
It actually is even tighter than that.
Oh, okay.
I just say a cautionary thing here. I don't know if anybody else in the room has ever filled in one of the big questionnaires they send that they get this data from. You may have. And I have, it's a big fat package when it comes. And for years at Microsoft, we had no idea. It bore no resemblance to anything we did. and it was usually given to the most junior person that was handy, who was instructed
and
to
that, fill it in
and get it the hell out of here and not to waste
but
too
that's
much
why
time on it.
So,
if this turns out to be important, then there's going to need to be some work done to, so that the data is cleaned up, and it's a real serious issue.
I've been thinking about this. I found out from a guy, I think it was you in Toronto, that Norway's data is much better. They do a system of national accounts based on the UN system. If their data is actually better, I'm going to run it again. But you're right. The data, the biggest argument against input-output stuff was the data has got a lot of issues with it.
But this, I'm trying to think of, okay, your AMI is growing over time, more or less.
Well, hopefully.
Yeah. No, what could be going on? And I think things happen like this. I do all my accounting in the early 1980s in my company. Now I outsource it to other companies who are in the accounting industry. So partly what you may be seeing is this, which is I'd like to touch this to some real phenomenon that we could sort of nail. So it would be that a lot of companies began outsourcing lots of stuff to business services, which was a giantly growing sector over this period, and almost by definition has to be getting things that are being bought by other sectors. So if you took a few sectors out like that, a few things that we think we know about actually what was going on in the structure of the economy, that'd be very helpful in interpreting what is now, my difficulty is, it's an aggregate thing about a giant matrix, not based on any principle I can grab hold of.
Yeah.
It's got these data problems, but I'm willing to sort of back off and just say, let's just see if you're still getting something interesting out. And you showed us the one interesting thing from the metal mining, which really said,
there's something here.
There's something there, yeah.
But you're right. This
is a place where it's so aggregate that you could probably use some artificial intelligence tools to explore some different disaggregation possibilities to give yourself some sense of, what was happening, because when an industry changes, like it used to sell software with a license, now it's a service, it's going to move over to another sector, but it's basically the same thing happening in slightly different ways. So you need to get back down from these aggregations with some analytics that let you kind of cycle a couple times and scrub the data. That could be approached. It would be a big job, but it could be done.
Well, the running it through cleaner data is always going to be nicer. I'm also, one of the big things, he touched on this, is I'm trying to re-derive these measures outside of an ecological paradigm. So what the heck am I looking at? And like I said, you can actually mark what the trophic measure is and what the ascent bad to trophic measure is if you view it as an optimization problem with shadow prices. So you can actually derive them.
Forgive me if this is trivial, but the idea of a high ascendancy measure meaning more resilience, is it blatantly obvious? Is it a strong assumption? Is it derived by some of the results here?
It's not an obvious thing. And so basically, Ioannilis just did it because he was trying to incorporate an idea he had. It sounds like it makes sense if you don't know information theory. If you know information theory, it's kind of like, it kind of hits you in the head.
Because this is extremely important for the question of systemic risk in the banking industry right now. The whole area that just started was network analysis of banking because of issues of interconnectivity. So
it's very closely related to interconnectivity measure. So you're right.
Yeah. But then the intuition goes the wrong way. It's like, it's not the problem that you're too big to fail, but that you're too interconnected to fail. So if you increase this It's been great instead of being more resilient.
Actually, that was something that Treasury was looking, at least some people in Treasury were looking at. And is it Beruzzi? Who's it, Beruzzi or somebody has a book on that that talks about the important nodes that are really interconnected?
Yeah.
And they're the ones that if they fail, the system fails.
So, but would that be captured, or would
if you have a highly central node, it'll bring down your AMI.
Will bring down, okay.
Because the thing is, your highly central node will add very little to the AMI, but also add flow to the system, so it'll bring down everybody else.
Okay.
Well, you've had this contradiction all along. When Robert May argued this back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
This whole argument about you have a relationship between diversity and stability of ecosystems.
And that's what it means.
Mathematically, it looks like more diversity is less stable, which is not what most ecologists argue. So it's sort of this very, and then it sort of ended up being this argument about the stability and resilience business.
Yeah, more diversity can be more unstable if the edges are randomly added. And this, there was actually a proof of this in the 70s and kind of shut down a ton of ecological work. The problem was, is the proof was dependent on the edges being added completely arbitrarily for the new system. If you add actually with a low number of edges, that proof becomes invalid.
It's also a question of cause and effect. Already unstable ecosystems tend to lose species. So anyway, just need to be cautious about that.
On the interoperability side, I want to make one link. Because one of the things that people have not done very much, almost nothing, it is important in terms of technical change. If I have a coefficient and I'm an industry and I'm buying something from another industry, and a good, and these coefficients are fixed the way they're calculated, so they're constant. And now I go to the next period, and I notice that that coefficient falls. That's considered a very good thing because it means I required less steel to make my car. Let's phrase it that way. That would be the way you think about it. And that's considered a positive thing. The connection I want to make is with P and Eric's things, because the problem we have with these kind of data is you don't know if that was a response to a price change, the steel price went up, or I have a technological innovation, which is the thing we want to see. I mean, either of them will both of them show up in here. That's very similar the analogy to the preference change, which is also meant to knock out the substitution component.
Production. Except sure.
It's the same. It's the
I'm trying to see quantity without
price
effects.
And we want to capture this technical improvement. That's gives us a really good sense of what's going on. You'd like an economy in which, this is now a little different than your AMI thing. It is. Well, you'd like those coefficients indeed to be going down a lot. If that means we're just making more and more with less and less.
If the total amount of flow goes down, AMI doesn't change.
What does it?
That's why you multiply it by total flow.
Okay, so ironically,
the AMI you could say is gauge invariant, to use the term everybody's using today. On the amount
more
of flow.
Linked to this other stuff.
If everything goes down, the AMI will more or less remain the same.
Okay.
Okay. I think we better close now, but let's thank Kevin.